Well, good afternoon, brethren, and it is so good to be addressing you today. I appreciate this opportunity. I have a really, what I think is a fun subject to be talking about. One of the question that I was asking myself is, what is the big deal with bull worship, with calf worship, with idolatry, especially with Baal? What is the big deal? Why was Israel so attracted to this form of idolatry that they left Jehovah over and over again? And so I did a bunch of research in that, and after doing the research, I did learn. I learned the answer to the question. I know what the pull is, but then it was extracting the lessons from that. And so that's what I'm going to be talking about today. So let me just start with a little encyclopedia speak. So the bull, there is a cult that's called Apis that is from Egypt. And this is from the Encyclopedia Britannica. And it says that this was really the first deity from the first dynasty in Egypt. So it goes way, 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 way back. And this Apis bull is kind of interesting because it was a real live bull. So, and it had priests, and it had a temple, and it had all this, but there were certain things about the Apis bull that I want to share. So this was the most important and highly regarded bull deity of ancient Egypt. Worship of the bull is recorded as early as the first dynasty, and there were a lot of ceremonies associated with the bull. So there would be, you've heard of the running of the bulls? Well, they had kind of a running of the bull. This bull was originally a fertility god. He represented eternity itself and the harmonious balance of the universe. So Apis is depicted throughout Egyptian history as a striding bull, usually with a solar disk between his horns. Apis bull was always associated with the king and the king's power. So whenever an Apis bull died, they would go on this search for the perfect bull. It had to be black and white, and it had to have a triangle on its forehead, and it had to be just a certain kind of bull. So they would bring the search of the bull. They would find the bull. They would bring it in to this temple area where it would go through the rituals of being inaugurated as the official Apis bull. And it was quite a deal. This is when all the crowds would come in and everything. And this Apis bull would be put in this pen, and they would have a number of gates around it, and they would put food in all the gates. Well, the people were allowed to ask the bull questions. And so then the bull would answer the question by which gate he would exit through. So it was there was divination involved. And so if the bull died, then the bull was, certain parts of the bull were eaten by the priest. But the rest of the bull was mummified, and it was buried in this underground area for the bulls, for the Apis bulls, and it was treated just like a king. So it would go through the mummification and all this kind of stuff. Now, a couple things that are interesting about this: they worshipped the bull, all right? They did all this adoration for the bull, but they did not think the bull was the god. They thought that the spirit of the god entered the bull. And so while the bull was the Apis bull, then they worshiped the bull, but they were really not worshiping the bull. They were worshiping what was in the bull. Kind of an interesting distinction. After 25 years, if the bull hadn't died, then it was ritually slaughtered and go through that whole same process of mummification, find the new bull. And another interesting thing is when the Apis bull was slaughtered, any children that he had were also ritually slaughtered. Its mother was ritually slaughtered. So the next Apis bull could not even come from that particular line. So this goes way, way back to the first dynasty in Egypt. And so, but the bull's death was not considered a death. It was considered to be a moment of transition from the spirit that was in the bull, then is leaving and is getting ready for the next bull. So that's a lot of bull. Now, what does all this bull worship have to do with Baal? Well, Baal is interesting all in itself, but they are linked. I'm going to try to share some of the story real quick. I don't want to take up the whole sermon time with just, you know, this encyclopedia articles are just absolutely fascinating. But we're going to try to move through this fast. The word Baal, or in Semitic language, it's just B-L. And, you know, the A's are the dots and the tittle, so to speak. So it's Baal is the way you pronounce it. And it's Semitic for owner or master or husband. It means the Lord. So Baal is the great weather god of the Western Semites. So there was a city in northern Syria called Ugarit that was discovered in 1928. And in that, the Ugarit texts were discovered. And this is where a whole bunch of information about Baal worship came from. So besides the names of Baal and Hadu, the Ugarit texts furnish a variety of other titles, such as Mighty Baal, the Prince, Lord of the Earth. The latter title has a biblical echo in the corrupted form of Baal-zebub, or in the New Testament, it's Baal-zebul. So kind of interesting. Baal is considered to be the son of El. Now think about that. El is Baal's dad. And then there's a lot of myths about that. Baal's abode is on Mount Sapin, identified as Jebel El Akra, which means Mount Baldy, some 30 miles north of Ugarit. And Baal, one of the sons of El, became famous and got power with his victory over the sea god Yam. So there is another god that Baal tangled with, who is named Mot. Now, this conflict between Baal and Mot has quite a story where for a while Mot wins, and then for a while Baal wins, and then Mot wins, and Baal wins. But what this has to do with is Mot is the god Mot represents famine and drought and death. And Baal represents rain and fertility and lushness. So whenever you had a drought in the land, then they considered Mot was responsible, and so they needed to really support Baal, because when Baal's in charge, then we get rain and we get, you know, vegetation, everything's growing. So up in Syria, they've got a lot of rivers. So they've got a lot of irrigation. So if you remember the story of Naaman the leper, and he's told to go dip in the Jordan, and he looks at the Jordan and he says, you know, this is a creek. Up in Syria, we got real rivers. Well, I could have, if I just needed to dip in a river, I could go use a good river. I wouldn't need to use this little creek. Well, that's true, that there aren't any big rivers in Israel. And so Israel is highly, highly dependent on rain. If it doesn't rain, they got big problems, because they don't have any rivers coming through that they can use to irrigate everything. Very, very important, because that is the pull. When you're a farmer and your crops aren't coming in and you got no rain and it's a drought, then people are going to get hungry. And, you know, you start thinking, you know, why, you know, how do we control this? How do we deal with this? So that's one of the things that we know. We're going to get into some stories in the Bible, but notice that Baal brings rain. And whenever you got a drought, the wrong God is in charge, and you got to fix that by bringing Baal back in. Okay? So you got a lot of conflict between Jehovah-ism and Baal-ism, but it's related to drought, to weather, and to things that's, you know, we can really connect with. So with that, I want to ask the question. You kind of know that Baal worship, bull worship, Baal worship, by the way, El was considered to be a bull, and Baal in the mythology is said to have mated with a heifer. And so you've got these gods are, you know, all have to do with this bovine stuff. So what is the big deal with this? I think one of the things that's important to realize is that they didn't think the bull was the god. Well, they also probably did not think that the statue of Baal was the god. As a matter of fact, if you know, you've seen how many images of Buddha have we seen in our lives? Well, the Buddhists don't think that the statue is the god. They think that if they look at the statue and they meditate on the right things, that the statue helps them realize what Buddha did, and they can connect that. But they don't think that the statue is the god. You look at in Catholicism, they don't think that the statue of Mary and Jesus are the god. They just are looking at it as a way of, they're thinking about the right things. It reminds them of things. The crucifixes of Christ that you see in Catholicism, you know, that's full. It helps them in their mind get their minds in the right place so that they can worship. The Kaaba is this big cube over in Mecca where Muslims are supposed to go on a pilgrimage at least once in their life. And if you've seen you know, pictures of this or videos of this, you'll see just crowds of people going around and around the Kaaba. Well, you know, they don't think that the Kaaba is Allah. They don't even think that Allah is in the Kaaba, but they've got mythology associated with it. And so you look at all this idolatry and everything, in their minds, they're not idol worshipers. In their minds, the idols just remind them of where their mind needs to be and what they need to be thinking about. It's kind of interesting. Over in Exodus 20 and verse 3 and 4, you've got the first and the second commandment. So let's look at that. It says, "And God spoke all these words, saying, I am Jehovah your God, who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of bondage. You shall have no other gods before me." So that's the first commandment. You shall have no other gods before me. And it says, "You shall not make for yourself a carved image, any likeness of anything that is in heaven above, or that is on earth beneath, or that's in the water under the earth. You shouldn't bow down to it. You shouldn't serve them. For I, Jehovah, your God, am a jealous God, visiting the iniquities of the fathers upon the children to the third and the fourth generation, and to those who hate me, but showing mercy to thousands, to those who love me and keep my commandments." Now, I want to point something out here, is that the second commandment is not an extension of the first commandment. So the first commandment is, "You shall have no other gods before me." The second commandment is, "Don't make any carved images," but he already said, "Don't have any gods before me." just another clarification. A lot of translations say, don't have any other gods except me. And that's really more accurate, because if you say don't have any gods before me, it's like you line up all the gods and then you put Yehovah right up in front. Well, that's not the case. But the problem, the second commandment is actually addressing worshiping Yehovah with idols and images. So we see that in Exodus 32. Exodus 32, this is right after Pentecost, when you've got the golden calf. So verse 1 says, now when the people saw that Moses delayed coming down from the mountain, the people gathered together to Aaron and said to him, come, make us gods that shall go before us. For as for this Moses, the man who brought us out of the land of Egypt, we do not know what has become of him. And Aaron said to them, break off the golden earrings which are in the ears of your wives, your sons, your daughters, and bring them to me. So all the people broke off the golden earrings which were in their ears and brought them to Aaron. And he received the gold from their hand, and he fashioned it with an engraving tool, and he made a molded calf. Then they said, this is your God, O Israel, that brought you out of the land of Egypt. So when Aaron saw it, he built an altar before it, and Aaron made a proclamation and said, tomorrow is a feast to Yehovah. Then they rose early on the next day, offered burnt offerings, brought peace offerings, and the people sat down to eat, drink, and rose up to play, which means, you know, they were doing stuff they shouldn't have been doing. But notice that they called the golden calf Yehovah. They attributed the acts of Yehovah to the golden calf. So keep that in mind as we go through this. Idolatry goes way, way back. Before Moses, before the Ten Commandments, we can read about that back in Genesis 31. Genesis 31. So you know, you got Jacob. He had to flee from his brother, and so he serves Laban for 14 years, and now he's in the process of getting out of that situation. So in verse 19, chapter 31, 19, it says, Laban had gone to shear his sheep, and Rachel had stolen the household gods that were her father's. Now they're up in Syria at the time. That's where Abraham was from. And Jacob stole away, unknown to Laban, the Syrian, in that he did not tell him that he intended to flee. So he fled with all that he had. He arose and crossed the river and headed towards the mountains of Gilead. So they had idols, right? And Laban said to him, go to verse 27, Genesis 30, verse 27. And Laban said to him, please stay. This is kind of interesting. If I have found favor in your eyes, for I have learned by experience that Yehovah had blessed me for your sake. Then he said, name your wages and I'll give it. Now, the reason I wanted to bring this up is in some translations, instead of the word experience, it says, I have learned by divination that Yehovah blessed me for your sake. Then he said, name your wages and I'll give it. So this is one of the translations that I have that have the word divination is the JSP, the Jewish Publication Society. But they were involved in idolatry. Now, as they flee, Jacob's going back home. He's going to go back to where Isaac is. And so if you look at Genesis 35, and verse 2, just to continue the story, and Jacob said to his household and to all who were with him, put away the foreign gods that are among you. Purify yourselves and change your garments. Then let us arise and go to Bethel, and I will make an altar there to God, who answered me in the day of my distress and has been with me in the way which I've gone. So they gave Jacob all the foreign gods which were in their hands and the earrings which were in their ears, And Jacob hid them under the terebinth tree, which was by Sechem. Now, just think about this. This is the second time that we've had earrings mentioned. And I was wondering, I kind of was connecting that back to whenever in Israel, if somebody became a voluntary slave, they had their ear pierced, and they had an earring, and the earring showed who they belonged to. Well, I just wonder if these earrings, which are associated with idolatry, didn't kind of link to who these people saw as their God. That's pure speculation, but I thought it was kind of interesting speculation. But on the way back to Israel, Jacob's got his little motley crew. He's going to get rid of all the idols and all the everything associated with idolatry before he gets to where his parents are and before he gets past the point of Bethel. Interesting. So another point that I want to bring out, okay, now was Israel ever involved in something that could be viewed as idolatry by the pagans? You know, how did the pagans view Israel and their religious practices? Okay? Well, one of the things I want to point out is that in 2 Samuel 6 in verse 2, I was really surprised when I learned this. 2 Samuel 6 at verse 2, it said, as David rose and went with all the people who were with him from Baal Yehuda to bring up from there the Ark of God. This is the Ark of God, whose name is called by the name Jehovah of Hosts, Jehovah Sabaoth. So the Ark where Jehovah dwells between the cherubim, it was called Jehovah Sabaoth. That's a lot clearer when you look at some other translations, especially Jewish translations. So that was the name of the Ark. Now, you remember the story when God had cursed Israel with the snakes coming into the camp. And then Jehovah had told Moses to make a bronze serpent. And then he had made the bronze serpent. And then anybody that looked at the bronze serpent would then be cured of the snake bites, right? But that stayed there for a long time. So during the time of Hezekiah, Israel was worshiping the bronze serpent. They were burning incense to it, just like they would any other idol. It had just become another idol. So Hezekiah had that relic destroyed. So, you know, an interesting question to ask is, what would you do if you could predict the future? If you had the ability to predict the future? A friend and I were talking about the movie Back to the Future, the second episode where Biff had found a sports magazine that showed the outcome of all the games, and so he knew what to bet on, and you know, knew what was going to happen. Well, you remember in Israel had, as part of the priestly garb, they had the Urim and the Thummim that they could ask questions. Should we go to battle? Should we not go to battle? Are we going to win? Are we not going to win? It was, you know, it was divination. Now, it was connected to Jehovah, and he put it in place. But think, to the outside pagan world, that doesn't look any different than what they're doing. They just have different gods. But they've got these relics of divination. So when the Urim and the Thummim were important, and you remember the story where Saul is facing the Philistines. And he's encamped at Gilboa, and Saul sees the army of the Philistines, and he's afraid. His heart is troubled, and then it says that when Saul inquired of Jehovah, Jehovah did not answer him either by dreams or by Urim or by prophets. So divination was kind of a part of how kings knew what to do and when to do it. I had an interesting experience just, I don't know, about a month ago. I belong to a group of business people that are from all over the world, and we get together and talk about our businesses. And I was surprised that to see this young Chinese man there, and you know, he was asking, what's your business? And he said, it's Chinese divination. And what? what is that? He says, well, you know, Chinese divination goes all the way back to, you know, the emperors of China have always used Chinese divination. And I, you know, I studied under a master, and you know, this guy has got a lot of this stuff computerized, but now that I understand, you know, with by looking at the stars and by looking at your birth date and by certain things, then, you know, I can tell the future with about 75% accuracy. And so I can, you know, I can demonstrate this to business people if they need to know whether they should buy stock, buy this, to, you know, I'm an advisor to corporations. That's what he does. This is a real business with a real guy. Now, if this guy had showed up at a business meeting and he had had black mascara on his face, or he had looked weird and bizarre, you would go, danger, danger. But he's just, you know, a sharp, clean-cut young man who just learned how to do Chinese divination, same thing that's been around for 4,000 years from his standpoint, and it's just a science, just like any other science. Another person, not in the same group, but was talking about they had been to a horoscope seminar, and they were really fascinated with that, and they were going to go to a horoscope school. And going to predict the future, you know, learn how to predict the future based on this. Well, this, you know, this is real stuff. This is today. This is 2021. This is not, you know, 2,000 or 3,000 years ago. People want to know the future, and they're willing to do some pretty crazy stuff. Now, if you talk to the Chinese divination guy, who claims he's about 75% accurate. He doesn't claim 100% accuracy, but about 75%. Well, that's enough to make a killing in the stock market. But if you talk to him and he gives you an answer, and he says, yeah, you do this and you're going to really, really prosper, then you got to look out for this thing called the placebo effect. We know that the placebo effect, just mentally thinking something's going to work, you can take a sugar pill, you think it's a medicine that's going to make you well, you take the sugar pill, and you get well anyway. Well, this is a scientific documented fact. So it's kind of easy to see how people can get sucked into this. You know, I got my horoscope thing. I said, hey, I was going to meet somebody, and boy, I met somebody, and I found $1 million, and here, you know, you want to know the future too? I can see the pull for that, especially if your crops are all drying up and you need rain really, really bad, and you're really, really looking for answers, and everything that you've done is not working. And then somebody says, you remember the rain god? You know, the people that lived here before, they had rain crazy. Remember, it was the land was flowing with milk and honey, and, you know, all this good stuff. Maybe we've ignored the source of all that blessing. So you can kind of see how you could get sucked into that. Let's go look at 1 Kings 12 in verse 26. Now, this is the story of Jeroboam. And he created a couple of calves, if you remember. 1 Kings 12, verse 26, and Jeroboam said in his heart, "Now the kingdom may return to the house of David if these people go to offer sacrifices in the house of Jehovah at Jerusalem." So Jeroboam, God had talked to Jeroboam and told him he was going to give him the kingdom. But now Jeroboam is afraid he's going to lose it. So he says, "If these people go offer sacrifices in the house of Jehovah at Jerusalem, then the heart of this people will turn back to their Lord Rehoboam, king of Judah, and they'll kill me and go back to Rehoboam, king of Judah." So Jeroboam's fears were bigger than the experience and what he had heard from Jehovah. So therefore the king, verse 28, asked advice, made two calves of gold, said to the people, "It's too much for you to go to Jerusalem. Here are your gods, O Israel, which brought you up from the land of Egypt." And he set one up in Bethel. Interesting place, isn't it? Bethel. Remember that from when Jacob was coming back. And the other he put in Dan. Now this thing became a sin, for the people went to worship before the one as far as Dan. He made shrines on the high places, made priests from every class of people who were not of the sons of Levi. Jeroboam ordained a feast on the 15th day of the 8th month, like the feast that was in Judah. He offered sacrifices on the altar. So he did at Bethel, sacrificing to the calves that he had made. And at Bethel, he installed the priest of the high places, which he had made. So he made offerings on the altar, which he made at Bethel, on the 15th day of the 8th month, in the month which he devised in his own heart. And he ordained a feast for the children of Israel and offered sacrifices on the altar and burned incense. So we're going to get back to talking about following the leader, but you got to kind of ask, why did the people follow Jeroboam? You know, why did they do that? Let's go look at 1 Kings and verse 17. This is the story of the big showdown between Jehovah and Baal. So 1 Kings 17 and verse 1 says, "And Elijah the Tishbite of the inhabitants of Gilead said to Ahab, 'As Jehovah God of Israel lives, before whom I stand, there shall not be dew nor rain these years except by my word.' Then the word of Jehovah came to him, saying, 'Get away from here and turn eastward and hide by the brook Cherith, which flows into the Jordan, and it will be that you shall drink from the brook, and I have commanded the ravens to feed you there.' So we went and did according to the word of Jehovah. He went and stayed by the brook Cherith, which flows into the Jordan. The ravens brought him bread and meat in the morning, bread and meat in the evening. He drank from the brook, and it happened that after a while the brook dried up, because there had been no rain in the land." So if you read the rest of chapter 17, there's a lot of miracles that he goes and he stays with the woman, and you know, God miraculously takes care of them. And so it's a fun read because there's just a lot of stories embedded in that. But if we flip over to 1 Kings 18, next chapter, it says, "And it came to pass after many days, the word of Jehovah came to Elijah in the third year, saying, 'Go present yourself to Ahab, and I will send rain on the earth.' So Elijah went to present himself to Ahab, and there was a severe famine in Samaria." Well, it hadn't rained for a long time. "And Ahab called Obadiah, who was in charge of his house. And now Obadiah feared the Lord greatly." That's Jehovah. "Greatly. For it was so, while Jezebel massacred the prophets of Jehovah, that Obadiah had taken 100 prophets and hidden them 50 to a cave and had fed them with bread and water." So now the story goes that Elijah's told to go talk to Ahab. And so Elijah suddenly appears to Obadiah. And he says, "Obadiah, you go tell Ahab I want to talk to him. I've been sent to Ahab. So tell Ahab to come here." And Obadiah says, "Are you kidding me? if I go tell Ahab that you're here, and then when I come back, you're not here, I am toast. I am dead meat. Do you hate me? Why are you doing this to me? And so Elijah assures him, no, I'm on a mission, and a mission from Jehovah, and I want to talk to Ahab. So Obadiah went, got Ahab, and told him, and then Ahab went to Elijah. And I'm looking at verse 16, and now in verse 17, said, then it happened when Ahab saw Elijah, that Ahab said to him, is that you, O troubler of Israel? Well, you know, I never really connected that before doing this study, that, O troubler of Israel, you're the guy that said it's not going to rain. You're the guy that says we're not going to have any dew. And this is all your fault. And so Elijah comes back and he answered and he says, I have not troubled Israel, but you and your father's house, in that you have forsaken the commandments of Jehovah and have followed the Baals. Now therefore, and now he's going to say, okay, we're going to have a showdown. You think that Baal is the one that gives you water. I'm telling you that it is Jehovah that gives you water. And so they're going to have this showdown. And as I go through here, Elijah, verse 22, said to the people, I alone am left a prophet of Jehovah, but Baal's prophets are 450 men. Therefore, let them give us two bulls, and let them choose one bull for themselves. They get to pick. Cut it in pieces and lay it on the wood. Put no fire under it, and I will prepare the other bull and lay it on the wood, but put no fire under it. Then you call on the name of your gods, and I will call on the name of Jehovah, and the God who answers by fire, he is God. So the people answered and said, it is well spoken. Now Elijah said to the prophets of Baal, choose one bull for yourselves and prepare it at first, for you are many, and call on the name of your God, but put no fire under it. So they followed. They're going to have the contest. If you go down to 27, you see that they've been calling on the name of Baal, and Elijah starts to mock them. So it was at noon that Elijah mocked them and said, cry aloud, for he is a god. Maybe he's meditating. Maybe he's busy. Maybe he, that word busy, the Jewish commentaries think that means maybe he's going to the bathroom. So, you know, maybe he's gone to the bathroom. Maybe he's on a journey. Perhaps he's sleeping. So Elijah is mocking them. So as a result, they cried aloud and they cut themselves, as was their custom, with knives and lances until the blood gushed out of them. Now you think about this. People are not going to be doing this if they're not true believers in Baal. They really think that if they bleed enough, if they endure enough pain, that it's going to get some result. So verse 29, when midday was past, they prophesied until the time of the offering of the evening sacrifice, but there was no voice, no one answered. So then Elijah, he comes in, said to all the people, come near. So all the people came near, and this is where he repairs the altar. He has them dig a big pit around it. They put the wood on the altar. They pour water over the wood, over and over, I think three times, and they fill up the pit. So verse 34, they do it a second time. So the water ran all around the altar, and it came to pass at the time of the offering of the evening sacrifice that Elijah the prophet came near and said, Jehovah, God of Abraham, Isaac, and Israel, let it be known this day that you are God in Israel, and I am your servant, and I have done all these things at your word. Hear me, O Jehovah. Hear me, that this people may know that you are Jehovah, God, and that you have turned their hearts back to you again. Then the fire of Jehovah fell and consumed the burnt sacrifice and the wood and the stones and the dust, and it licked up the water that was in the trench. Now when all the people saw it, they fell on their faces and they said, Jehovah, he is God. Jehovah, he is God. And Elijah said to them, seize the prophets of Baal. Do not let one of them escape. So they seized them, and Elijah brought them down to the brook Kishon and executed them there. Then Elijah said to Ahab, go up, eat and drink, for there is the sound of abundance of rain. So Ahab went up to eat and drink, and Elijah went up to the top of Carmel. Then he bowed down to the ground and put his face between his knees. And this is where he had his servant go back and check. Do you see a cloud yet? No. Do you keep praying? Do you see a cloud yet? And so forth. And in verse 44, it says, it came to pass the seventh time that he said, there is a cloud as small as a man's hand rising out of the sea. So he said, go up, say to Ahab, prepare your chariot and go down before the rain stops you. Now remember, it hadn't rained in 3 years. Now it happened in the meantime that the sky became black with clouds and wind, and there was a heavy rain. So Ahab rode away and went to Jezreel. So Jehovah demonstrated that he is the one that brings the rain. It is not, it's not Baal. So what are the lessons that we can learn from this? Well, I came up with several. I'm not going to tell you how many because I don't know how I'm going to work the clock to see what I can fit in. But the first lesson that I'm pulling from this is that the people that we allow into our lives have a profound effect on our thinking. The people that we associate with, their beliefs, what they believe to be true, have a lot to do with what we think. We have a need for social interaction. One of the commands in Deuteronomy 7 and verse 1 says, when Jehovah your God brings you into the land which you go to possess, and has cast out many nations before you, the Hittites, the Girgashites, the Amorites, the Canaanites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, the Jebusites, seven nations, mightier, greater and mightier than you, then, and when Jehovah your God delivers them over to you, you shall conquer them and utterly destroy them. You shall make no covenant with them, nor show mercy. You shall not make marriages with them. You shall not give your daughters to their sons, nor take their daughters for your son, for they will turn your sons away from following me to serve other gods. So the anger of Jehovah will be aroused against you and destroy you suddenly. But thus you shall deal with them. You shall destroy their altars, break down their sacred pillars, cut down their wooden images, and burn their carved images with fire. For you are a holy people to Jehovah your God. Jehovah your God has chosen you for a people for himself, a special treasure above all the peoples on the face of the earth. So brethren, that sounds harsh. I mean, that's harsh. But the principle here is a little leaven. Leaven's the whole lump. Just a little bit. If they leave any of that, what is the effect? It's going to be profound. Turn over to 1 Kings 11 and verse 1. 1 Kings 11 verse 1 says, but King Solomon. Now, King Solomon was a smart guy. He prayed for wisdom. He talked to Jehovah a few times. Jehovah appeared to him. But King Solomon loved many foreign women, as well as the daughter of Pharaoh. Women of the Moabites, the Ammonites, the Edomites, the Sidonians, and Hittites, from the nations of whom Jehovah had said to the children of Israel, you shall not intermarry with them, nor they with you. Surely they will turn away your hearts after their gods. Solomon clung to these in love, and he had 700 wives, princesses, and 300 concubines, and his wives turned his heart away. Now, this is the wisest guy that ever lived. Verse 4, for it was so when Solomon was old that his wives turned his heart after other gods, and his heart was not loyal to Jehovah his God as was the heart of his father David. For Solomon went after Ashtoreth, the goddess of the Sidonians, and after Milcom, the abominations of the Ammonites. Solomon did evil in the sight of Jehovah and did not fully follow Jehovah as did his father David. Then Solomon built a high place for Chemosh and the abomination of Moab on the hill that's east of Jerusalem, for Molech, the abomination of the people of Ammon. And he did likewise for all his foreign wives who burnt incense and sacrificed to their gods. So Jehovah became angry with Solomon, because his heart had turned from Jehovah, God of Israel, who had appeared to him twice. Now think about that. What did Solomon think through this? Or did he think, well, I can handle it. You know, they won't affect me. I can handle it. I mean, I'm Solomon. I'm the wisest guy in the world. Let's go to Ezra. Ezra and verse 10. Now this is, Israel had gone into captivity, and then they had come back, built the second temple, or may have been in the process. But in Ezra 10, verse 1, it says, Now while Ezra was praying, and while he was confessing, weeping, and bowing down before the house of God, a very large assembly of men, women, and children gathered from Israel, for the people wept bitterly. And Shenaniah, the son of Jehiel, one of the sons of Elam, spoke up and said to Ezra, "We have trespassed against our God and have taken pagan wives from the people of the land. Yet now there is hope in Israel in spite of this. Now therefore let us make a covenant with our God to put away these wives and those who have been born to them, according to the advice of my master, and of those who tremble at the commandment of God, and let it be done according to the law." Well, that's harsh. You're going to put away your foreign wives and your foreign children. That is harsh. Why was that necessary? Well, it's because they had sinned. And if they hadn't put them away, they would have been right back into the idolatry that forced them to go into captivity in the first place. And so it was, they had to take extreme, uncomfortable, difficult, painful measures to get things right, to set things right. In Proverbs, the first chapter of Proverbs, there's a warning. If we look, Jehovah's talking about, I don't even have the, let's see, it says, if they say, "Come with us, let us lie in wait to shed blood, let us lurk secretly for the innocent without cause, let us swallow them alive like Sheol, and whole like those who go down to the pit, we shall find all kinds of precious possessions, we shall fill our houses with spoil, cast in your lot with us, let us all have one purse. My son, do not walk in the way with them. Keep your foot from their path, for their feet run to evil. They make haste to shed blood. Surely in vain the net is spread in the sight of any bird, but they lie in wait for their own blood. They lurk secretly for their own lives. So are the ways of everyone who is greedy for gain. It takes away the life of its owners." Who we choose to hang out with is important. And if we think that we can hang around with people with poor character and it's not going to affect us, then we're just deluding ourselves. Our brain, what goes into our brain is going to have a lot to do with what comes out. Our input controls our output. You put garbage in, what comes out is garbage. So there's, you know, also a warning about TV, about movies. What are we putting into our brain? If we think that we can expose ourselves to the ways of the world, so to speak, over and over and over again and not be affected, then, you know, we're playing with fire. We're playing a very, very dangerous game. It affects us more than we know in ways that we can't even comprehend. So God gives us his way. Remember Deuteronomy 30, verse 19. Deuteronomy 30, verse 19, a very familiar scripture. I call heaven and earth as witness today against you that I have set before you life and death, blessing and cursing. Therefore choose life, that both you and your descendants may live, that you may love Jehovah your God, that you may obey his voice, and that you may cling to him, for he is your life and the length of your days, and that you may dwell in the land which Jehovah swore to your fathers, to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, to give them. So brethren, you know, God sets it before us. We just have to choose, but we have to choose carefully. And so you got life, then you got death. And then you got all this stuff in between that influences us. We have to be careful. So where do false beliefs come from? Well, unfortunately, we're dealing with a Bible that's been rewritten a lots and lots of times, and it's gone from this language to this language to this language. So we're dealing with some translations errors. We're looking at dozens of manuscripts that you know, 98-99% of the time they agree, but in certain areas they don't agree, and they're all ancient manuscripts. And so we've got some challenges, translation challenges, but compared to what is plain and simple and easy to understand, those challenges are minuscule. If we understand history, which we have clearly documented history, we are reading God's word in context, and with all the you know, the internet gives us access to tools to check original languages and check with multiple sources. We have Bible study is so easy now compared to what it was back in 1970s when everything had to be books all over the table. So we're kind of without excuse. 1 Corinthians 10 and verse 1. We can think, brethren, that these stories that we're reading are, you know, don't really apply to us today. But I tell you, they do apply today, and we need to think about them today, and we need to ask, what can I learn from this? What can I learn? We need to dig, because these things are important. So 1 Corinthians 10, verse 1, "Moreover, brethren, I do not want you to be unaware that our fathers were under the cloud, all passed through the sea, all were baptized unto Moses in the cloud and in the sea, all ate the same spiritual food and all drank the same spiritual drink, for they drank of that spiritual rock that followed them. That rock was Christ, but with most of them God was not well pleased, for their bodies were scattered in the wilderness. Now these things became our examples, to the intent that we should not lust after evil things as they also lusted. We do not become idolaters as were some of them. As it is written, the people sat down to eat and drink and rose up to play. Nor let us commit sexual immorality as some of them did. And in one day 23,000 fell. Nor let us tempt Christ as some of them also tempted and were destroyed by serpents. Nor complaining, as some of them also complained and were destroyed by the destroyer. Now all these things happened to them as examples, and they were written for our admonition, upon whom the ends of the ages have come. Therefore, let him who thinks he stands take heed, lest he fall." And when we read over these scriptures quickly, then we cannot give them the respect that they need. So, brethren, have we really proven all things? We know that prove all things and hold fast to that which is good. But have we proven all things for ourselves? for ourselves, or are we kind of taking people's words for a lot of things that we believe? There's a concept in psychology that's called lock on, lock out. It's an interesting concept because what it means is when we lock on to a certain belief, that our minds, more than anything else, they want us to be right. And so they start filtering, our minds will filter information. So we build scotomas or blind spots to anything that doesn't match what we believe to be true. And then our mind wants us to be right more than it wants us to be happy, more than it wants us to be successful, more than anything. The carnal mind wants to be right. And so then it starts gathering piles of evidence to support what our position. So that we're not on a search for the truth, we're on a search for evidence that we're right. Well, we're all like that. But if we recognize that, then we can dig a little deeper and we can prove it 100%. We can, instead of listening to the authority, we can listen to God's word. Instead of listening to our friends, we can check it out. Check it out. Dig deep and make sure that we have a good reason to believe what we believe, that we have an answer for the hope that lies within us. I've been in the COGs for quite a few decades. And the COGs had a set of teachings that was warm and it was comfortable. It was good to be in a group of people that was right when the whole world was wrong. And we were just, you know, right there, we had the truth. But we had to learn something. We have to keep reading. And we have to quit reading for a confirmation that what we believed is right. Because over the past several years, we've discovered a lot of big issues where we didn't have it nailed down. And it may have been comfortable, but it wasn't right. And when one of those false beliefs fell, then it started kind of like a one of those dominoes things where this one hit over the next one, hit over the next one. And it's kind of interesting. The next thing I want to talk about is the third lesson is that God does not tempt us, but he does test us. And that's an important distinction. James chapter 1, verse 13 says, let no one say when he is tempted, I am tempted of God. For God cannot be tempted by evil. He does not he himself tempt anyone, but each one is tempted when he's drawn away by his own desires and enticed. Then when desire has conceived, it gives birth to sin, and sin when it's full grown brings forth death. So let's talk about it. Is there a difference between tempting and testing? Flip back to Genesis 22. Genesis 22, verse 1. Now it came to pass after these things that God tested Abraham and said to him, Abraham. And he said, here I am. He said, take your son, your only son Isaac, whom you love, go to the land of Moriah, offer him there as a burnt offering in one of the mountains which I shall tell you. So then you skip down to verse 11. You know the story here. It says, but the angel, the Malak, the messenger of Jehovah, called to him from heaven and said, Abraham, Abraham. So he said, here I am. He said, do not lay your hand on the lad or do anything to him, for now I know that you fear God, since you have withheld your son, your only son, from me. I want to point just an interesting thing out here. In Hebrew, there is no third person. And or I don't speak Hebrew fluently. I'm learning a few words, but I understand there is no third person. And so if a messenger comes from Jehovah, that messenger is going to speak in the first person. Even though he's just a messenger, he's still going to speak in the first person. And that kind of straightens out some of this dialogue and some of the misunderstandings we had where we thought that you know, Christ was the God of the Old Testament at one time. But anyway, go to Matthew 4 and verse 1. Then Jesus was led by the Spirit into the wilderness to be tempted by the devil. And when he had fasted 40 days and 40 nights, afterwards he was hungry. It says, now the tempter came to him and said, and so then you have the tempting. Well, what's interesting about this is if you look at Hebrew Matthew, the word, the Hebrew word for tempted is the same word that is used for tested for Abraham. So Christ went into the desert to be tested by the tester. Kind of an interesting thing. If you let's go to Deuteronomy 13, talking about testing. Deuteronomy 13, verses 1 through 5. If there arises among you a prophet or a dreamer of dreams, and he gives you a sign or a wonder, and the sign or the wonder comes to pass, of which he spoke to you, saying, let us go after other gods, which you have not known, and let us serve them. You shall not listen to the word of that prophet. So this is one that has a dream, and the dream actually comes true. It says, you shall not listen to the words of that prophet or that dreamer of dreams, for Jehovah your God is testing you. It's a test. To know whether you love Jehovah your God with all your heart, with all your soul, you shall walk after Jehovah your God and fear him and keep his commandments and obey his voice. You shall serve him and hold fast to him. So the question is, will we be faithful? Will we be faithful when it doesn't rain? Or will we turn to the rain god? Will we be faithful? The book of Hosea is all about spiritual adultery. Don't have time to read stuff from there, but if you think about a newlywed couple goes to some event, and the husband is talking to some people, and over there he sees somebody flirting with his wife. And then he kind of wants to know, you know, is she, you know, liking that or not liking that? Well, that's kind of the way Jehovah has looked at flirting with these foreign gods. You know, are we going to be faithful to him? Or are we going to just reject it, have nothing to do with it, kill anybody that, you know, has anything to do with that? Or are we going to kind of, well, that sounds interesting, tell me more. You know, are we flirting with that? Okay, lesson number 4 is why do we believe what we do? And are we believing it because it's our idea, because we read it in the Word? Or are we believing it because of groupthink or because of what people around us are thinking? You know, this is a really interesting subject because there was an experiment that was done in a college where they had a professor, and there were 3 lines up on the board, and they were all different lengths. And it was a setup. Some of the students in the classroom were part of the test. And the question was, which line is the longest? Well, it was clear which line was actually the longest. But then the professor went through and found out what everybody thought, and the students that were cooperating with the experiment said the wrong line. They said the middle line was actually the longest line. And so then they got the tally, and you know, there was only a tiny group that were not part of the test. And so they were looking at the board, and, well, you know, you got the whole class says the middle one's long, but it's clear, you know, you got all this confusion. And so they start talking about it. They start talking about, well, why do you think that's the longest? And, you know, have you had your eyes checked? Have, you know, what's, I mean, it's clear to us that this is, and they would talk more, and they say, okay, well, let's take another poll. And when they would go through again to see which line was longest, the people that were not part of the test, the ones being tested, they now all said that the middle line was the longest line. Even though they knew, the group think affected them, and they thought, something's wrong with me. Well, I can definitely, you know, sympathize with that, because when I first came into the church and started studying the Bible, you know, I wasn't familiar with the Word, and so there was a lot of things in there that was confusing. But one of the things that was confusing was when I would read what the Bible said, but then I would hear what was being said, you know, from the pulpit, and it didn't match. And so I didn't, you know, what I thought was, something's wrong with me. I don't understand it. You know, I'm defective. You know, if he says it right, he knows. I mean, you know, we went to school and does everything, and what do I know? I'm just starting. And so I would question my judgment when actually the Bible was clear. I just didn't have enough faith in Jehovah to just read it and believe it and reject what was clearly didn't match. So I, you know, that's kind of a, I totally relate to that. We need to be part of a group. We that's a part of our makeup. We want to belong. When, you know, we talked earlier in 1 Kings 18 about the story of Elijah facing the prophets of Baal. Well, even after that, if you go over to chapter 19, you have Jezebel had threatened to retaliate. So I'm going to kill Elijah. You killed all my prophets. I'm not happy about that. I'm going to kill Elijah. And so Elijah kind of runs and hides. But he's also seriously depressed, because he's talking to Jehovah, and he says, you know, I'm the only one. I'm here all by myself. I'm the only one that'll stand up. And he's praying to God. He said, just kill me. It's, you know, this is too miserable, too painful. And so Jehovah was very gentle with him and sent a messenger, an angel, that tapped him on the shoulder and gave him some food and did that a couple of times. And then he tells him, go on and eat, because I've got a mission. And then he goes and sends him on his mission. He has to anoint three different people. But it is hard to be alone and to be isolated and to feel like you are the only one. It is very, very difficult. So another thing I want to ask is, are we following the leader? We've talked a little bit about this, but if you look at the kings of Israel just as a whole overview, you see a good king is doing things right, temple services are going right, and the nation's blessed and the people are fine. But as soon as the bad king comes in and he brings in Baal worship and Asherah worship, then the people just follow. They just follow the leader. So where does that come from? And what would we do if we were in that situation? My parents had a sort of a ranch, had about 100 horses. And in dealing with the horses, stallions and fillies are like totally different. Stallions can run those fillies to death. They will not. They don't move until that stallion tells them they can move. And he herds them all together and he controls them. But there's safety in that, because that same stallion will face down a cougar. He will face down a pack of coyotes. He will protect the herd. And so there is, you know, it's kind of nature tells us that if you're in tune with the leader, that the leader's going to kind of protect you. So we have to really ask ourselves, have we proven all things? Are we believing what we believe because Jehovah has told us what to believe? Or are we believing what we believe because it's comfortable, because it feels good, because it's warm and fuzzy? Because we're in a dangerous situation there. In Ezekiel 34, you've got this blast against the shepherds of Israel on how they misused and abused the people of Israel, the flock. And you got to say, well, why did the people continue to follow them? Well, because it was more comfortable being part of the herd than it was not. So number five is don't hedge your bets. Let's go to James chapter 1, verse 2. Craziest scripture I ever heard in my life. It says, my brethren, count it all joy when you fall into various trials, knowing that the testing of your faith, God got testing in bold, testing of your faith produces patience, but let patience have its perfect work, that you may be perfect and complete, lacking nothing. If any of you lacks wisdom, let him ask of God, who gives to all liberally without reproach. It will be given to him, but let him ask in faith, not doubting. For he who doubts is like a wave of the sea driven and tossed to and fro. For let not that man suppose that he will receive anything from Jehovah. He is a double-minded man, unstable in all his ways. So we were talking earlier about when the land is parched, and are you going to have faith in God? Are you going to pass that test? Are you going to, you know, worship Jehovah? Are you going to do everything, or are you going to hedge your bets? Well, let's do just a little bit of Baal. You know, let's just keep doing Jehovah. Let's do just a little bit of Baal. So we, you know, we got everything covered. Well, that's synchronism. And there's a lot of stories that I could tell in the Word about the dangers of synchronism. God is jealous. He doesn't want to share the stage with anybody. And so adding Baal to hedge your bet is not a thing to do. It's like Elijah said, if Jehovah is God, worship him. If Baal is God, worship him. Don't do both. So wrapping this thing up, James 4 and verse 17, memory scripture, to him who knows to do good and does not, to him it's sin. Brethren, as you read God's word and as you understand more and more, not everyone will agree with you. Not everyone learns everything at the same time. So we have to be patient with each other. John 16 and verse 12. John 16 and verse 12. Let's remember this. Christ said, I still have many things to say to you, but you cannot bear them now. However, when he, the Spirit of truth, has come, he will guide you into all truth, for he will not speak on his own authority, but whatever he hears, he will speak, and he will tell you things to come. He will glorify me, he will take of what is mine and declare it to you. All things that the Father has are mine, therefore I said that he will take of mine and declare it to you. It is the Holy Spirit that leads us into all truth. And so we need to be mindful of that. You know, Matthew 5 and verse 14. Says that you are the light of the world. A city that is set on a hill cannot be hidden, nor do they light a lamp and put it under a basket, but on a lampstand, and it gives light to all who are in the house. So let your light shine before men, that they may see your good works and glorify your Father in heaven. We are to be the light, brethren. We are not to fall for the counterfeits. Now, how do you know if something is counterfeit or whether it's the real deal? Well, you have to be very familiar, even intimate, with the original. Our eternal life depends on our ability to recognize and surrender to the truth. And that is all dependent on how well we know Jehovah's word. So, brethren, all I can say is keep reading.